This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. This past weekend, the Just Transition Northwest Indiana organization gave citizens in the Michigan City area an opportunity to see a documentary film about the hazards of coal ash, which many people in Northwest Indiana are very aware of. It's, of course, a toxic byproduct of burning coal. And the film that was shown also focuses on Indiana's utility industry and some of the hazards from that. And with us to talk about the screening of the film entitled In the Water, we have with us Susan Thomas, who's the legislative director, and Ashley Williams, who is the co-founder of Just Transition Northwest Indiana. And ladies, thanks for joining us on Regionally Speaking today.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
Will you take a moment, and I'll let you decide who wants to lead off on the question here, what Just Transition Northwest Indiana is and how they got involved in wanting to screen this documentary this past weekend?
Yeah, I'll jump in. So, here with Just Transition Northwest Indiana, really our mission is about building solidarity between workers and communities that are affected by the NIPSCO energy transition. And so really the idea with the documentary screening, which focuses on the issue of toxic coal ash, which is the waste product of burning coal, is to really talk about those legacy impacts. What does that actually look like as we face a transition, a retirement off of coal to renewable energy? And so there's a lot of these legacy impacts. And for us, it's really talking about being able to redress and heal the harm done with environmental injustice issues, such as with NIPSCO's coal plants, and really talking about what does that look like for our communities for the future to come together and really define what does a just transition mean. That term can tend to be nebulous, but we really believe in that concept because it really talks about the holistic ways of how we can come together to build that deeper meaning. And so for us, that's really what it comes down to. And really, again, building the bigger we and thinking about that future vision for the Northwest Indiana region that has been so heavily industrialized and impacted by the fossil fuel industry and its legacy.
Will either of you tell us a little bit about the filmmaker herself, Beth Edwards? Beth Edwards is a lady that did the research. Tell us a little bit about her, because she has an environmental journalism background, and what prompted her to do the research that in turn led to the creation of the film?
Well, as you know, she is an award-winning environmental journalist at the Indiana Environmental Reporter. And if your listeners are unfamiliar with this publication, it's really a superb newsletter that comes out frequently documenting and doing deep dives into the environmental issues that impact the state of Indiana. And Beth is one of their journalists, and she just started interviewing folks, and it all came together for her. And, you know, she was able to weave together the chemistry of coal ash with experts and academics with the human impact. So, you know, you get the personal, very heart-wrenching stories of folks who have had coal ash dumped on their entire town, such as the town of Pine. And also folks like from the Hoosier Environmental Council talking about the statewide impacts and the industry approach. She also, you know, extremely fairly had several industry insiders stating their cases as well. So it was extremely thorough. And as a documentary itself, it is so well done and a really lovely film that you will think about for days, hopefully weeks after, and hopefully do something about it, take some action.
I understand that Beth did a lot of research in this. She managed to get a lot of documents together that helped her put the documentary together, in particular the problems in the town of Pines. We're aware of what this has had to be done in the past as far as the remediation of some of the coal ash that was used extensively in the town. Will you tell us more, if you will, about what Beth found and that she put together as the basis for her film?
Yeah, so with the town of Pines, this is a town that's just west of Michigan City, a very small town. And what really happened was the town of Pines contamination actually goes way back. A lot of folks don't know this, but it really is two chapters of this contamination. Back in the day, they actually used coal ash for road beds and for yard fill. At the time, just as with a lot of the now known carcinogens or toxins today, we didn't have that information right in the 1970s or pre-EPA. So they took this coal ash, and it was sort of a giveaway from NITSCO, and they took it and they filled in yards and roads and so on with this. So think about it in that part. And then later on, NITSCO needed somewhere to truck their ash, the 1 million tons that ultimately leached into the groundwater supplies, forever contaminating their well water as well as with their soil. So that began to happen pretty much over the course of years and years and years with this trucking. And slowly, but you know, surely, of course, it began to migrate. And the town of Pines and the residents, you know, really did not know what was happening, right? That they were being poisoned until the early 2000s, when you had the group of citizens that just came together. They had no previous organizing, really, or advocacy experience. They certainly didn't, you know, consider themselves as that, but they came together. And they saw that there was injustice. They knew that something was happening. Their well water was turning colors, right? They knew that they were drinking something that should not have been in their water. And lo and behold, they did they did a lot of citizen investigation, appealed to the EPA, and they were able to actually get it declared an alternative Superfund site because of them, as well as with Earth Justice and other allies being able to support them. This would have never happened if not for the town of Pines blowing the whistle on what NITSCO was doing. So they really should be applauded. And that's really what the film spotlights is their journey, really through the lens of Kathy Murray, who was very much impacted as well as their family, not fully even realizing what does those impacts fully look like. A lot of the time, right, we're talking, you know, years and years to come. How can you say that, again, that was that the actual cause of different issues within your family? But I know with them, without a doubt, they certainly believe that it's a consequence of the toxic environment that they live in.
I know that because of the lawsuit that was filed against NITSCO, that, of course, led to a lot of the correction of some of the issues, I guess that they're still working through in the town of Pines, is it not?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And they, you know, so with the alternative Superfund site, that's been going on for some time now with the remediation, with the cleanup, and ultimately the remediation. The lawsuit was settled. There is still 38 homes that are currently on well water. So they sort of picked and choose with the contamination plume. Who gets access to municipal water? Michigan City Municipal Water is what was routed into the town. And the rest of the 38 homes were not given that opportunity. And that's another thing with, you know, we are not, you know, I live here in Michigan City and Susan Beverly Shores. It's really for the town of Pines to speak for themselves and advocate for that. But certainly through our conversations, we feel like, and especially with building a lot of solidarity with town of Pines folks, is that why doesn't everyone have universal access to municipal water? Why is that not a right? Right, they had their rights stolen from them, from NITSCO. And so we really want to continue to advocate for that, that justice needs to be served. It hasn't, you know, there's still the town of Pine story has not been completely written, right? So that's another thing, too, is really talking about that. And then, of course, what we're dealing with here now in Michigan City with the Lakeshore film.
We're talking with Susan Thomas, who's a legislative director, and Ashley Williams, who's the co-founder of the organization called Just Transition Northwest Indiana. And the organization just had a screening of the documentary film entitled In the Water. It was screened this past weekend at Pullman Park in Michigan City. And it's a film that deals with the Indiana's utility industry and some of the hazards that have been brought about and documented in the town of Pines of using coal ash for various purposes. purposes, as it was mentioned earlier, was used for road fill as well as for land, for filling around residences, homes. And since they've had to deal with this matter and are trying to remediate all this, I imagine it's brought out even more attention to not only the general problems of coal ash, but also some of the uses of it. Had any of this discovered, as far as you know, newer and probably safer ways of using coal ash?
Oh, my goodness. There are ways to repurpose coal ash safely. It can be encapsulated into a cement-like product for building materials, into a wallboard-like product that is completely safe. There is a professor, and forgive me, I forget which Indiana school she is with, mm-hmm. but she has discovered a way to extract rare earth elements from coal ash. And as you know, rare earth elements are what power all of our smartphones, most of our technology, and they're extremely expensive, and they're mostly available through China. And if we could make this a local industry by repurposing coal ash for this process, there's so much money to be made off of this. And you know, this is a very beneficial reuse of coal ash.
This is, I guess, an interesting film that has actually not only gotten attention because of its advocacy nature, being as it is, but also for cinematic reasons. It, I guess, got a lot of attention with the Indianapolis Film Festival. It picked up an award, I understand.
Yeah, that's right. We're really excited for Beth Edwards and the Indiana Environmental Reporter and being able to be recognized for this and celebrated for an issue that so heavily impacts the state of Indiana, right? We have more coal ash ponds than any other state. We're number one for all of the wrong things. We are also, when it comes to toxic pollution, we're number one within the country as well. So, you know, this is really sounding the alarm that we have this emergency unfolding throughout the state. You know, we are in a time of climate crisis. Coal ash is all part of it, and you know, burning coal for electricity as well as with fossil fuel. So she's really being recognized as she deserves, and we're so honored to be a part of it.
Now, Susan, I understand that since you're the legislative director for Just Transition Northwest Indiana, you get the opportunity to work with groups, and I suppose that you've had the opportunity to work with the Hoosier Environmental Council certainly about this, and maybe working with them in the future so that if there are changes that have to be made legislatively through the General Assembly and in upcoming sessions, you're able to do that.
Well, I cannot say enough about the Hoosier Environmental Council and the work that they do, and they are extremely nonpartisan. They maintain neutrality at all times, and the work they do is so needed in the state of Indiana. However, I will emphasize that we actually helped write two bills on coal ash for the state Senate and the state House, and they both got nowhere. Mm-hmm. And we have had to really shift our focus to a federal level because it's unfortunately become abundantly clear that state legislators in Indiana do not want to touch this topic, with the exception of Pat Boy and Karen Talion, who authored these bills. We couldn't get a single Republican co-sponsor for them, which is necessary with the supermajority. We did get a co-sponsor in the Senate. I take that back. Mm-hmm. So we are approaching this now from a federal level, and we're talking with Congressman Mervon. We spoke with Senator Todd Young, and we encourage your listeners to contact their senators and congressmen and talk about coal ash and the need to clean it up in Indiana. There is a great law that is a bill that is on the books right now. Sponsored by a Democrat out of Tennessee named Steve Cohen, Congressman Steve Cohen, who has witnessed firsthand the devastation of a coal ash disaster in his state. So we are really hoping that folks will sponsor this, and it is called Ensuring the Safe Disposal of Coal Ash. That is what we are hanging our hopes on right now.
Susan Thomas is the legislative director. Ashley Williams is the co-founder of Just Transition Northwest Indiana. And ladies, thank you for joining us today to talk about the presentation of the documentary film In the Water that was screened this past weekend in Michigan City. And we hope to hear more and maybe more opportunities to screen the film later. Thank you for being with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you so much. We really appreciate it. You take care.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Remote working took off in the pandemic, and in response, more communities are luring remote workers with cash and other incentives, hoping they boost the local economy. And now a group in Indiana is getting in on the trend as it launches the first such program in the state. But Indiana Public Broadcasting's Justin Hicks reports some researchers have doubts that luring remote workers is really the best strategy for growth.
Campus tours happen all the time at Purdue University, but one recently was a little different. Instead of fresh-faced high schoolers, they're actively recruiting adults with jobs that allow them to work remotely.
This is the world-famous Bell Tower, Purdue Bell Tower, so you can see it almost anywhere on campus.
And here's what they're offering. Stipends of up to $5,000 plus whatever campus amenities one could imagine, as long as they work remotely from the school's campus in West Lafayette for 1 year. Christian and Zoe Martin, a married couple from Los Angeles, don't remember where they heard of this particular program, but they do remember all the flashy ads they saw when they started looking into remote working programs.
And they say, oh, this program will give you $5,000, this program will give you $10,000, this program will give you $20,000. When we started doing the research and saying, okay, are these real?
Turns out these programs are very real. Christian and Zoe started applying for all the ones they could find.
After this, we're going down to the Shoals in Alabama, and that's like a different remote program. We're going to check out and see what they have to offer and kind of go with an open mind.
And already they're noticing something. They're being competed for.
And that feels a little strange, you know, especially when we're just like, you know, young people who are just working.
Evan Hawk, co-founder of Indianapolis-based MakeMyMove.com, helps places start incentive programs, including this one at Purdue. He says people like the Martins who can keep their good-paying jobs and live just about anywhere are a huge untapped weapon in an emerging arms race for communities to attract workers.
And there were 5 million remote workers in January of last year. There are now north of 60 million. Best estimates we've found is about half of those, some 30 million, will be full-time remote even post-pandemic and can choose their new home.
Hawk expects the benefits will outweigh the costs of these incentives. These remote workers will pay taxes, buy houses, eat out at restaurants, and just generally be these sort of model citizens that boost the local economy. And those splashy gimmicks like money and mountain bikes given to a few people is just the bait to start a conversation. For instance, Purdue's program is only actually paying up to 10 people, even though 15 to 20 are expected to move. And Hawk points out this idea of competing for jobs isn't new. For decades, local governments battled each other to offer all sorts of incentives that create jobs. But it was almost always geared towards companies.
The same theory that says, hey, if Amazon brings that job that's worth X number of dollars to my community applies to the remote workers. Like, we're seeing American life shifting. And so suddenly, these workers can choose where they want to live and they can wield that economic power.
But not everyone is so eager to jump into this bold new future of remote worker incentives. Timothy Bartik, a senior economist at the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research, is skeptical. He says there's no proof these programs are actually as effective as proponents claim.
The first issue is, do they have any effects on migration? The second is, even assuming they do have some effects, what are the benefits of that versus the cost?
Bartik says local governments might find it attractive because handing out money to new residents is easier than other, more politically intensive strategies. Strategies like removing barriers for foreign immigrants or investing in schools. And he warns if it doesn't have a noticeable effect on the economy, it could alienate people who have lived in communities for years, who never even got an incentive to live there.
Well, it's obviously good for the people who migrate. Why is it good for the local population? Why should local residents pay higher taxes to pay for these things?
Evan Hawk with MakeMyMove.com says they plan to collect data and gather as much evidence as possible on these programs. But in the meantime, Hoosiers can expect to see more of them in Indiana. French Lick, Jasper, and Bloomington are also in the process of launching their own incentive programs. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Justin Hicks.
Young women in Indiana are working hard, despite the pandemic, to change their communities. Side Effects Public Media reporter Darian Benson spoke with a first-generation Mexican-American from Warsaw in northern Indiana, and here's her story about seeking justice for immigrants.
My name is Maria Duenas Lopez. I am 22 years old. I am the president and founder of Warsaw Area Voters, a community organization made to increase voter engagement in Kosciuszko County elections. In 2016, I figured I'm a young woman, Latina, and it's like, so what role does my vote have in a Republican supermajority state? Probably not a lot. India's more left-leaning, but Warsaw is not. It's very conservative. I'm like, my vote doesn't matter. Really, after seeing AOC win, and after seeing all these other women of color around the U.S. winning in competitive districts, I was inspired. I was like, you know, what if it does? What if it does count? When we recognize that our vote does count and that it does make a difference, then we're empowered to cast our vote. We're empowered to take a stand in civic engagement in other aspects of our lives. Democracy means having elected officials that truly represent their constituents' points of views. Democracy is having basic human rights, which include the right to vote, the right to education, the right to drive, and it means a lot to the immigrant community because we all came here in some way because democracy offers a better life for us than whatever system of government we had before, whatever we experienced before. And this is why we put our lives on the line when crossing borders. The democracy in this country is something to fight for. Can't speak for everybody, but that's why we're here. Democracy is the reason a lot of us are here. Young people have the most important role in democracy because we kind of set the tone for what we expect from government. We will protest if there's injustice, and we will fight through organizing, through activism, through any form that we can. We will fight for what is right and set the tone for how people in power should respect us, how they should view us. I think that has been super evident this year.
This audio diary was produced as part of the America Amplified Initiative, a national public media collaboration focused on community engagement reporting. This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. Well, it is no secret that women tend to earn less over their lifetime compared to men, and sometimes having to take time off from work to take care of children, aging parents, and even their spouses' parents. Women, again, have come in to the rescue to help their families during the pandemic, and that's according to the U.S. Bureau of Labor Statistics. Over 2 million moms have been forced or opted not to work during the pandemic to be able to help youngsters with their schooling. And today we are joined by Deborah Cundiff, who is a senior financial advisor, and Tamara Taylor, who is an insurance specialist. And they both run a division at Hammer Financial Group here in Northwest Indiana called Woman's Worth, to be able to talk about why women of all ages ought to pay a particular attention to their finances compared to their spouses. And ladies, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Thanks so much for having us, Chris.
Well, Deb, if you will, first, why does this seem to be a problem for women as far as finances are concerned?
You know, unfortunately, even brief absences from our employment can have a negative impact on our ability to retire comfortably, Chris. According to the Center of American Progress, women who lose wage growth, or lose retirement savings while taking time away from work can actually lose up to 4 times their salaries.
Wow.
Think about a 30-year-old female who earns $50,000 a year. Assume she takes 3 years off from work. She'll actually experience over $417,000 in total lost income.
Yeah, nobody, I think, decides to look at the cumulative effect of all this, and that's right. There are tens of thousands of dollars of lost income when the one person who is part of the breadwinning part of the family has to step aside for whatever reason it is, to be sure. And this is a big financial loss for women, is it not?
It sure is.
Yeah, that's right. You know, even with the pandemic or not with the pandemic, taking time off of work should be a significant consideration for women, because statistically, women outlive men by more than 5 years. And Chris, keep in mind, 80% of women die single and 80% of men die married. So when making financial decisions, many couples really don't take that into consideration, that, you know, women are going to tend to live longer than their male counterparts. And in many cases, these women have taken additional time off to care for their children or for their aging parents.
Now, I know that when Greg Hammer and I get together for a conversation about financial matters, we spend a lot of time, not all the time, but a lot of the time talking about Social Security. What should women know about claiming Social Security? It's probably a point that many women do not think about.
So true. Women really need to understand the importance of optimizing their Social Security, because it is going to represent a significant portion of their income in retirement. There are actually over 500 different ways to claim your Social Security benefit, and that amount is based on our 35 highest earning years. So you can imagine that zeros can bring our benefit calculation down.
Yeah.
You know, if we've taken time off to care for our young children or our aging parents. Another consideration, Chris, is deferring. Do we want to wait even beyond our full retirement age to take our Social Security? For every year that we wait, our benefit actually grows by 8%. So pushing back that date for taking our benefit can add up to $10,000 a year, which can be life-changing, right, for seniors who are living on a fixed income. Women who often outlive men, as Tammy mentioned, face more medical expenses. So we really do need to think long and hard about the benefits of deferring.
Yeah, I know that's a major concern, even with men worrying about Social Security, the fact that if you do retire and you do have a relatively comfortable income that you can fall back on, you still have all of those expenses with medicine and with hospital treatments and everything else that can happen, too, to be sure. Well, and added to that, and talking about health care and medical costs, many people think that it's all the same as long-term care, but it really isn't, is it?
No, it really isn't, Chris. A single woman retiring today, she can expect to need about $150,000 for health care costs over her lifetime. And on top of that, 75% of residents in nursing homes are women, with the average stay in the nursing home being somewhere between 2.5 to 5 years. And the average cost of those stays are about $100,000 a year right now in today's dollars.
Mm-hmm.
So although many people are hesitant to purchase long-term care insurance because, you know, they don't know if they're going to use it or not, the statistics really show that 70% of people over the age of 65 are going to require some form of long-term care services or some type of support over their lifetime.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand some life insurance companies are also making it easier for women, too, by offering some better opportunities to be able to prolong the benefits if a husband passes away.
Yeah, there are life insurance companies that are out there now that have long-term care policies that have a life insurance component associated with them. So these types of policies are called asset-based long-term care, and they can be used for either long-term care services, but if they're not used for long-term care during their lifetime, they will provide a death benefit to their loved ones, you know, the people that they leave behind. So then it's not a use-it-or-lose-it situation.
We're talking with Deborah Cundiff, who's a senior financial advisor, and Tamara Taylor, who's an insurance specialist. They both are working with Hammer Financial Group, and they run a division called Women's Worth about issues that will affect women financially, to be sure. Well, we would be remiss if we didn't talk about taxes. It always comes up in other conversations. What about taxes as far as women are concerned?
Well, Chris, I always say it's not what we make, right? It's what we keep.
Mm-hmm.
So we tend to look at our retirements and think, hey, you know, we're fine. But what we're not factoring in, Chris, is that we're actually in partnership with the government on our IRAs, our 401ks, our 403bs. So it's really important to develop tax mitigation strategies so that we can tap into that nest egg that we've worked so hard to accumulate in the most tax-efficient way. Now, the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act has offered us historically low tax rates. We do have a rare window of opportunity here to do Roth conversions. In other words, rip off the Band-Aid now, knowing that we are in these, you know, more favorable tax brackets, so that we're not forced to take these dollars out in the way of RMDs in higher tax brackets. And, of course, as Tammy mentioned, right, 80% of women die single. So we all know that the single tax bracket is not kind.
And also, too, it turns out that if it's a particularly difficult time of life, I guess, with being in the single tax bracket in that way, you're spending an awful lot of time being in that because you're going to survive the spouse a lot longer than many people think, I would imagine.
Absolutely. Right. So, you know, income planning in retirement is just that, right? It's, you know, what is our monthly net need in retirement, and where is that coming from? So women should seriously consider increasing their promise-based income by purchasing income for their retirement.
Mm-hmm.
An annuity can provide lifetime income, which for women who do often face long longevity risks can make a ton of sense. Ultimately, you win when you live long with an annuity.
Now, Tamara, let me ask you in closing today, what seem to be the differences between working with men and women in terms of their finances?
Well, Chris, what Deb and I have really noticed with the women we have worked with
mm-hmm.
is when their spouse does pass, they tend to feel lost as they typically really have not been as engaged in their finances as they should have been. In many cases, they really do feel they haven't been listened to by their husband's advisors. So we really recommend to the women that we work with to try to get involved early on in their finances so this doesn't happen. A crisis really is the last way a woman wants to, you know, to have to learn how to manage her finances. But, in some cases, that's just what happens, and she does learn to do it on her own, and sometimes that can be very empowering for women.
Well, it just sounds like that it's wise for men and women to have good financial help from advisors, and at least we hope we've gotten some off to some people thinking about that today. Deborah Cundiff is a senior financial advisor, and Tamara Taylor is an insurance specialist. They both run a division at the Hammer Financial Group here in Northwest Indiana called Woman's Worth. And ladies, thank you very much for the advice and the information, and we hope to have a chance to be back together again soon. Thank you. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for joining us. Coming up tomorrow, we'll have more for you from the Porter County Recycling and Waste Reduction District on how last weekend's household hazardous waste collection went and some new programs going into the summer months. Hope you can join us tomorrow.